Welcome to Public Policy This Week, a well-rounded weekly discussion of policy issues that frame today's American experience.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, September 30th, and you've joined us for Public Policy This Week here on KYMN Radio.
Public Policy This Week is dedicated to the honest and open discussion of public policy issues. Each week, we take a look into a specific policy subject, and we have guests on the show that are experts in their fields. To the greatest extent possible, we stay away from politics and instead concentrate on research, facts, and the experience and insight of our guests to help us to arrive at well-thought-out, comprehensive, integrative solutions to the shared challenges we face in society.
Our program runs the gamut on policy subjects from neighborhood concerns to municipal, state, and even national-level issues. Everything is fair game on this show. Our objective is a civil, thoughtful dialogue about important public policy issues that convey ideas and solutions to move our society forward.
Today on Public Policy This Week, we will be discussing the police service career of Todd Axtell, our guest in the KYMN studio. Additionally, we will be talking about the next phase of Todd's life as he embarks on a new career direction, leading a consulting firm. As part of our discussion, we will cover the changes that have occurred in law enforcement over the 30-plus years of Todd's career, what attributes are necessary to be an excellent police officer, how to recruit, train, and retain excellent police officers, the effects of George Floyd's in-custody death and the defund the police movement on law enforcement, rebuilding community trust, and how to combat increases in violent crime, among other important law enforcement-related topics.
Todd Axtell is the former chief of police for the city of St. Paul. He's also the co-founder, president, and CEO of the Axtell Group, a public safety, security, and law enforcement consulting firm focused on helping police departments and public and private organizations and their leaders improve efficiencies, minimize risk, and achieve strategic goals. Prior to launching the Axtell Group, Todd dedicated more than three decades of his professional life to public service, including 33 years with the St. Paul Police Department. He retired from Minnesota's Capital City Police Department earlier this summer.
Throughout his career, Todd has championed trust, transparency, community engagement, diversity, and the highest levels of accountability. He and the team he surrounded himself with are credited with helping make the St. Paul Police Department a model of excellence that is emulated and admired throughout the state and country. Todd's accomplishments garnered local, state, and national attention. In fact, on June 1st of 2022, as proclaimed by the governor of Minnesota, it was Chief Todd Axtell Day in both the city of St. Paul and the state of Minnesota.
And Todd Axtell continues to make his home in St. Paul with his wife. Chief Todd Axtell, welcome to Public Policy This Week. It's a pleasure to have you on our program.
Thank you very much. It's really great to be here, especially in an area where I spent a significant amount of my time growing up.
Yeah, you were mentioning that before we came on the radio. You grew up here in Northfield for a little while?
Yeah, the first 8 or 9 years of my life I spent here with my family. My father worked for Sheldahl when it was operating here in Northfield, and my mother was a hairdresser. Actually, a part of the time, a hairdresser in the building we're sitting in today. So I have some great memories of fishing in the Cannon River right behind us here. And just, yeah, it's fun to see how the circle brings us back together here today.
Yeah. Let's talk for a minute about Chief Todd Axtell Day in the state of Minnesota. When I left the police department, they gave me a watch, and they gave me a dinner. And I'm sitting at a Minnesota Wild game this spring with my wife, Chris, and being honored in front of 19,000 people at the game is Chief Todd Axtell to announce this statewide Chief Todd Axtell Day. What did I do wrong in my career?
Well, I bet you still have that watch, and people certainly aren't going to remember the fact that I had a day, but it was quite an honor to be recognized is something I'll certainly never forget. But, you know, every police officer, every public servant, regardless of what we do, is such a meaningful job. And today, as I reflect on how difficult it is to get young people into policing, it's so important that everybody understands that their role in serving our communities is so critically important, and we need everybody paddling in the same direction.
Let's get into it. Getting ready for our program today, and this goes back to the mid-90s, I was thinking about why I wanted to become a police officer in the first place. It was the uniform. It was about being part of a team. It was the training. It was the physical and mental challenges that are different than any other profession out there. The responsibility, and also this strong idea of protecting those in society that have a hard time protecting themselves. Go back 35 years. Can you recall why you wanted to make police work a career?
Yes, absolutely. You know, my grandfather was a police officer in Silver Bay, and he happened to die at the age of 47 of a heart attack. Hmm. And so I was 2 years old at the time, and that really piqued my interest. And so throughout the rest of my young life, I always wanted to really follow in my grandfather's footsteps and honor him in that way. So from a very young age, I knew I wanted to be a police officer, and I knew what it meant to be a police officer, and to be in the service of others is so critically important. And we certainly don't do it for the money, right? It's not about the money. It's about being in the service of others.
Right. Well, what was your training path into law enforcement? How'd you get into it specifically?
So I remember when I graduated, we ended up in Brainerd for the last 2 years of my high school. So I graduated in 86. And at the time, my lifelong goal, again, was to be a police officer. So I went to a two-year program in Alexandria, Votech, and that was going to be it. That was the ceiling for me. I wanted to be a police officer, and my first job was in Breezy Point and Pequot Lakes, working half-time in each of those agencies until 1989, when I came to St. Paul about a year and a half, year later. And then, you know, over the last 33 years, there's been some incredible things that have crossed my path in my career, which allowed me to retire as the chief.
Both Joe and I ran for office a couple of years ago. I had an opportunity to talk with a number of police chiefs back then, and I did a master's program at the Humphrey School a few years back, and I talked to some police chiefs then as well. And the Alexandria program is still sort of the model that everybody talks about. People who are in positions like you were as chief, the model that they really look to and say, boy, that really worked well. It was very effective at training law enforcement officers who eventually became leaders on their forces.
Yeah, it really did create that great foundation. You have to show up every morning in your uniform, on time, squared away, work hard, study hard, and you live right there in the area. It was a great opportunity.
So, you know, I'm not a law enforcement professional, but I happen to be sitting in a room today with two of them. Considerable police experience and accomplishments in our studio this morning. My co-host, Joe Moravchuk, had experience in Wisconsin's third largest department as a patrol officer, an evidence technician, a field training officer, and on the target enforcement and the major crimes teams before being promoted into administration. Chief Axtell, what roles did you have within the St. Paul Police Department throughout your career? What roles did you enjoy the most? And in what roles did you believe that you contributed the most to the department and the city? And perhaps, were there initiatives that you launched while you were chief that, about which you are particularly proud?
Yeah, thank you, and thank you both for your service over the many years to our community, and certainly, John, to our country as a Navy veteran. Appreciate your service. You know, I have been so fortunate in my career to have the opportunities I had specifically in St. Paul. I started as a patrol officer on the east side of St. Paul, and I did that for quite a few years. Had opportunities to work over the years after that in narcotics, vice, special investigations, the gamut of the department, so investigations, and then I was able to, I got lucky on a few tests, went back to school to get my bachelor's and master's degree from St. Thomas, and then I started on the promotion track and used my experiences to help the units that I supervised over the years. As far as some of the accomplishments, and none of the accomplishments I ever talk about is certainly because of me. It's because of the people that we surround ourselves with. Of course, having the right people at the table and the right team, and making sure people sitting at your table aren't people who will always agree with you is so important. And that was kind of my mantra in the police department, to have people challenging me. I would say that the Law Enforcement Career Path Academy that we created just after I became chief in 2016 has been such a great opportunity. We partnered with AmeriCorps, Century College, I went out and pounded the pavement to get funding from through our foundation to pay for this program, where we have young people from our community who faced barriers into law enforcement, whether that's transportation, family issues, finances, but they're good people. They had a great heart for public service. So we paid them a livable wage to learn the police department for a few years to get their schooling. And since that time, we've hired over 30 police officers from that program, 30 police officers who will hopefully serve each 30 years plus. And so I view that as a big win, especially during times as we are now with the challenges we have with hiring people into the profession of law enforcement. As I have had the opportunity to pin so many badges of the young people when they become police officers, it's something that I'm very proud of, and the fact that we have young people from our community who look like our community, who understand the community and have served 3 years getting to know the community before they ever answer their first 911 call is just a game changer for law enforcement.
Yeah, I think I was certainly grateful to be in major crimes and some of the other opportunities I had with the police department, certainly administration, target enforcement. But I think I was always a patrol officer at heart. I really like that connection with the community. You know, the squad car is your office. You think you were a patrol officer at heart, even though you eventually made it all the way up to the top and led an organization?
Yeah, always. I mean, that's why, as you know, Joe, that's why we get into the job, is to get behind that wheel and get out there and meet with business people, our community members. Get to know everyone and have a positive impact on their lives and help protect victims of crime. That's why we get into the job. And then everything that happens after that is just a product of that.
Chief Baxtell, over the length of your career, you have no doubt seen many changes in police work. I can think of a few myself. Perhaps you'll recall the North Hollywood shootout in 1997. Heavily armed bank robbers took on the LAPD, who at the time were simply outgunned by automatic weapons. Many departments issued semi-automatic handguns as a result of that incident, and long guns and squad cars, shotguns, MP5s, AR-15s. Of course, the Columbine shooting in Colorado in 1999, most departments had to implement new training protocols to combat these school shooters. And then most obvious, the changes to technology post 9/11. HD cameras, police body cameras, cell phones, and Stingray technology systems that track cell phones. What are some of the big changes that you observed or implemented during your long police career?
Yeah, there's been a lot of change since I became a police officer back in 1988. You know, for the first few years, you would get into a squad car. There would be no computer. You would have a radio, the police radio, of course, and then you have the handheld radio that you carry. And as a matter of fact, our chief at the time, Chief McCutcheon, who just died about a year and a half ago, a wonderful man, I had so much respect for him, he actually pulled the AM/FM radios out of our squad cars because he wanted us to pay attention to what was going on in the community. So technology was really not where we were at when I started. And then over the years, having a front row seat to see when we have the first computers that went in the squad cars, and eventually having the opportunity as chief in St. Paul to implement our body-worn camera program. And that really has been a game changer. And reflecting back on your earlier point about the Hollywood shootout, that had a significant impact on tactics and law enforcement
for
throughout
sure.
This country. We knew that we were outgunned at that time. Shortly after I came on before I came on in St. Paul, we had revolvers.
Yep.
And I actually carried a revolver when I was a cop up in Pequot Lakes and Breezy Point. And it's, I still remember it was a Ruger GP100 with a nickel plated with a fancy, the fancy wood grip on it. And so we've changed a lot over the years, putting patrol rifles in our squad cars to make sure that we can protect our officers and help our officers protect our community has been critically important. The tactics that we use, Columbine, you mentioned, making sure that we no longer wait. We go in. We have to neutralize the shooter first and foremost to protect people. And so, yeah, it's been great to have a front row seat and actually be involved in some of the evolution of that technology.
That the like the 911 dispatch system that would have come on, was it you were fairly new as an officer at that point, the 911 dispatch system?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly, recall the year that had happened, but the 911 system was in effect at that time.
Okay.
I remember back to Breezy Point and Pequot Lakes, which are great police departments, but the how I got that job is I pulled up at a restaurant in Pequot Lakes. This is, you know, before the internet really was prevalent, and I saw a young what I thought was officer, and I introduced myself, and it happened to be the chief of police who hired me on the spot to work in Pequot, and I was on patrol the next day. So that was my training program, and then what I'm doing is I'm listening on my first traffic stop, and I'm listening to what other officers in the county do, and they're dispatched out of Brainerd, the Crow Wing County Dispatch Center. So the squads would stop a car, and then they would ask for a case number. Mm-hmm. Well, I thought, well, okay, I'm going to stop a car for a traffic violation, and I'm going to ask for a case number like the other officers are. And there's a long pause, and the dispatcher says, yeah, Pequot, you have your own case numbers. So and our case number book was on our desk in the little office that we had. So I had a long way to go at that point.
I do want to ask one more follow-up question on the technology side. The police body cameras that all the officers wear, what kind of an impact has that had on your officers?
You know, there was certainly a lot of trepidation when body-worn cameras came out with our officers. It was new technology. They didn't know what the policy would really be, what it looked like.
I felt the same way. Even with the new, when they put the cameras in squad cars at first, we would have VHS tapes in the trunk that we had to pull each night.
Right.
But all of us, I think, were a little reluctant to that new technology.
Right. And now what's happened over the years is our officers refuse to go on the street without it. It really it gives you a unique perspective as to what happens on the street. And it's interesting. Sometimes we'd had a call in the Internal Affairs Unit in St. Paul since the implementation of body-worn cameras, and somebody would call to complain about an officer, and the person answering the phone in Internal Affairs says, well, that, you know, we'll certainly look into that, and we'll pull the officer's body-worn camera and take a look at the incident, and we'll send you a packet you can fill out. You know, and sometimes there's this long pause, and they're like, what'd you say about a camera?
That's exactly right. Yep.
And then all of a sudden they want to withdraw all their complaint. So it's helped officers. It's helped with transparency and trust. And trust has to be the foundation of everything a good police agency does in this country. It's one of the biggest pillars we have.
When I was a shift commander, sure was nice to have those videos to review incidents. You could clear them up really fast when you see something on camera.
Absolutely. I reflect back at one of the last officer involved shooting deaths we had in St. Paul. The officer was driving eastbound on, I think it was Sherburne Avenue, beautiful afternoon on a late summer day, and minding his own business, and he's rear-ended by a vehicle. And thankfully, you know, we had had the body-worn cameras for a while, so the officer's muscle memory was there to make sure that he tapped the camera right away, not knowing what was about to happen. And thank God he activated that body-worn camera, because when he got out of a squad car, there was a man about 5 feet away coming at him with a knife trying to kill him. The officer had to retreat and unfortunately had to pull the trigger and take the man's life. Immediately, there were people who began to protest and started coming out with the false narrative about one of our officers killing a man unjustly, and I was able to share that video and talk about what happened, and the protest disappeared. So it's something that really has helped our officers, and they firmly believe in it.
That actually, Chief, is a great segue into the next question that we'd like to ask you. What are the key attributes that someone must have to become an excellent police officer. As obviously, you don't want anybody on the force who is not imbued with a high degree of integrity, right? It's just the profession requires it. You have to have the knowledge of and understanding of the state laws, the municipal codes, etc. You need to be able to perform the defense and arrest tactics effectively. You have to be physically fit. Communication skills are really important. Obviously, a strong work ethic. It's not like you guys work short shifts when you're out there. And courage. Courage is very, very important. But how about things like discretion, critical thinking, problem solving? One of the things I like to talk about my friend Joe Moravchik is that he's imbued with a deep amount of emotional intelligence, which I think is one of the things that made him a great police officer, and certainly compassion. All the years that you served, leadership positions up and down the chain of command, well, in your view, what are the most important characteristics, the foundations of excellence for that make for a great police officer?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's so important because when you look at when you hire a police officer, you're for the most part, you're really stuck with the person that you hire for many years, and it's a huge investment, and
a lot of money goes into these trainees,
yeah. And there's a lot on the line. Yeah. Somebody can deteriorate the relationship that we have with our community. The list goes on and on. First and foremost, I always focused on hiring the heart. The heart of the human being, it has to be someone who really gets it, has that emotional intelligence. I've always said that we can train people to safely stop a car. We can train someone to write a ticket. We can train someone how to safely navigate a domestic dispute. But if you don't have the foundation of a good heart and a good human being, there's nothing that we can do. We can't teach you how to be nice and be kind and be respectful. Mm-hmm. So that's the first and foremost thing that I looked for. And I always say that, you know, you hire the heart and train the mind. And that was our philosophy.
Hmm. And a follow-up to that, when you were appointed chief of police as part of your leadership agenda, you instituted training programs for your officers on ethical policing and on moral courage. What were the main ideas that you were teaching along those lines with ethical policing and moral courage, and why do you consider those concepts to be so important? Maybe you could give an example or two of things that happened on the street with your officers after having gone through that training and performance of their duties.
Yeah, ethical policing is courageous. That's a program that we taught starting a few years ago, and then moral courage training. Chad Weinstein with ethical leaders came in and helped us prop up that training for our officers. EPIC is actually our officers really embraced this training. Ethical policing is courageous. They made their own pins. So it is really generated from within the highly respected street officers who helped train it. Basically what it is not just allowing but demanding officers step in and prevent escalating situations where an officer may be losing their temper, mm-hmm. about to do something that is against our community standards, our police department standards. We actually do the hands-on training and the acting and the role-playing. So if an officer gets heated and you can see something as bad is going to happen, and another officer steps in, touches the officer on the shoulder and says, "I got this," mm-hmm. right? And now our officers understand that that's part of what we do. And if it continues, they call out EPIC, I got it. And then they have to step back.
Okay.
Regardless if you're the chief of police or a frontline officer, it applies. Everybody must step in and prevent something bad from happening. And it's really helped. I've had stories come back to me where officers have stepped in and prevented somebody who's having a bad day. And sometimes that's just what it is. Our officers are human. They put their pants on one leg at a time. They have financial issues. They have marriage issues. They have family issues, aging parents, all of the things that come with being a human being. So we need to acknowledge that, and we need our officers to have the tools to step in and prevent bad things from happening.
When you were appointed chief of police as part of your leadership agenda, let me fast forward here to something else. The best police officers understand that when hands-on force is necessary, it should be done skillfully and quickly. And then once someone is in custody, the officers have to make sure that everyone is okay, including the person in custody. Hands-on force often should be a last resort, unless, of course, it's an emergency situation. As part of your leadership agenda, you trained your officers about de-escalation. What is de-escalation and why is it important?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, we've evolved over the years with how we've viewed use of force. And I know, Joe, you've been through the same evolution of this type of training. When I came on the job, the academy instructors in use of force would basically say that you need to remember three things. If you need someone to do something, you ask them, you tell them, and then you make them. Mm-hmm. And there was really, that was the foundation of how we train, right? And so that's obviously changed quite a bit over the years. And we use our communication skills. We try to de-escalate situations. We slow situations down. We now have mental health officers working with social workers to try to de-escalate some situations. We're walking away from situations that in the past we never would have. Example, somebody who may be threatening their own life and they're alone and nobody else is in danger at the time. Why are we going to kick a door in and force a potential deadly mm-hmm. encounter over someone who's having a real bad day and may come down, and we have social workers that will call? And so we've really changed our approach quite a bit. I've always told our officers that if you can answer the affirmative to these three things, that I'll always have your back when you have to take action. And you have to ask yourself, were the actions reasonable, necessary, and done with respect? And if you do those things and remember those three things, you'll always be okay. So yeah, the de-escalation, the crisis intervention training that our officers go through, understanding the signs of mental illness and people who are suffering crisis is really critical as we move forward.
You know, both of you just brought up a couple of great points there. As I've sort of observed what society has lumped onto the backs of the police in Minnesota and across the nation, we sort of expect police to solve all of these societal ills when your job is really law enforcement, not handling all the other crises that we have in society that probably should be handled by properly funding other programs to deal with those things, drug addiction, mental health, et cetera. Do you kind of agree with that, having been, you know, the one expected to handle all of society's ills?
Yeah, there's certainly more put on the plates of our police officers than ever before. And I've talked frequently about this in the past, that it can't be an either or approach to the dynamics our officers are facing. We have to invest in mental health resources. We have to invest in chemical dependency, all of the things that lead people to intersect with the criminal justice system. We have to invest in, and we have to invest in having enough officers to deal with the 911 calls when our community really needs us. And the either or, I believe, is a false narrative that we should stay away from. It should be and. We need both things. And while we do the prevention and early intervention, when that starts to show results where we may require less police officers, that would be wonderful. Mm-hmm. But until that happens, we can't afford to do that.
That's a great point, Chief. You're listening to Public Policy This Week on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1, and we're broadcasting out of Northfield, Minnesota. I'm John Olson, and my co-host today is Joe Moravchik. Joining us on our program this morning is Todd Axtell, CEO of the Axtell Group, and the recently retired Chief of Police for the City of St. Paul.
When I was a police officer, I believed that the badge I wore was to be a symbol of faith and trust to the citizens that I served. And when I was a sergeant and then shift commander, I would tell patrol officers often that they are the most visible representatives of our city. Thus, it's imperative that they represent themselves, our department, and our city each day with integrity. Like you, I worked in a diverse city with much going for it: industry, technology, opportunity, beauty, but also its share of challenges. Throughout my career, I worked to better our city and the relationships between the police and citizens. But then on May 25th, 2020, A Minneapolis police officer, Derek Chauvin, pins George Floyd to the ground during an arrest, knee on his neck, and for 9 minutes, the world watches a video where a local police officer unnecessarily causes a fatal injury to a citizen. I knew at that moment the faith and trust that I believed the badge represented and so many officers believe in and so many citizens count on was going to be tarnished. When you wore the badge representing St. Paul, what did that mean to you? How important was leading with integrity to you? What was your initial personal reaction to Derek Chauvin's actions on that fateful May Day? And then what was your immediate concern for police work as a career after what occurred at 38th and Chicago in Minneapolis? I had a lot of emotions that day. I imagine you did too.
Yeah, I sure did. That was a day that I'll certainly never forget. It's probably one of the most, if not the most significant law enforcement action misstep in our nation's history. It, you know, I've always operated under the philosophy in St. Paul is the bank of trust we have with our community. In every positive thing that we do with our community, every time we treat someone with respect and get out of our squad and help our community, is a deposit into that bank of trust. And it takes thousands of those deposits to maintain a high level of trust, especially with all of our diverse communities in St. Paul. And so what happened that day, and we've had our, you know, our incidents in St. Paul, of course, throughout the years, and nothing like this. But when these things happen, and certainly what happened in Minneapolis on that day, made not just a significant withdrawal, but it just demolished our trust accounts throughout this entire country. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I thought of is, I remember feeling is how sick I felt watching that video and knowing that there is no excuse for what I was seeing there. The lack of humanity was disgusting to me.
It was a lack of humanity, and I didn't even understand the tactical aspect of it. Yeah. The training was completely out the window.
Yeah, and so I was an emotional day for me. I took to social media and I posted up my thoughts on that day that I have printed out and kept ever since. And I remember speaking with our officers because at the time this happened, you know, things were heating up in Minneapolis, and we thought they would be heating up in St. Paul too. And I remember sitting in my conference room with the leaders of our department, starting to stand up our mobilization for the department, knowing that it's not a matter of if, but when. Yep. Something's going to break loose in our city. And during that meeting, we hear on the PA system that businesses in the Midway neighborhood of St. Paul are beginning to be looted. Mm-hmm. And that was the most trying week of my entire career, as we had that night, the next day, 36 buildings on fire in our city, businesses on fire, over 300 businesses were being looted. All hands were on deck and our cops were exhausted. And, you know, I was sad and I was pissed. I was really pissed that that officer in Minneapolis, I won't even repeat his name, did what he did and caused such a significant withdrawal out of our bank of trust. But I'm so proud of the women and men of our department and departments across this country who really really showed up and kept our community safe and brought some brought some calm back to the chaos that was occurring at the time.
Yeah, if you don't mind my saying, Chief, I watched you sort of remembering that day, and I could see in, you know, the audience can't hear you the way I can see you, but I could see that it emotionally impacts you even to this day. What you saw on TV in what happened to George Floyd.
Yeah, thank you.
That tells me that you do care deeply about the community that you serve.
Yes, and there have been some good things. Thank you. There have been some good things that has come out as a result of that tragic day in Minneapolis. And policing has moved forward since then. Our officers, all officers, we're reminded that day that you mentioned the symbol of the badge, Joe. It's never a symbol of power, right? It's a symbol of service. Mm-hmm. And we can never lose sight of the fact that why we are here. And you're right. We're the most visible form of government that people see on a daily basis. And we have to take that very, very seriously.
In the aftermath of George Floyd's in custody death, there was the defund the police movement, and many in politics and media became highly critical of the police, some questioning the necessity for police at all. As a result, crime has risen, and in a time of rising crime, many departments have scaled back proactivity. For instance, specialized street drug and crime, gun crime units due to political pressure and loss of officers. In fact, many officers throughout the country have taken early retirement, leaving departments far short of the required personnel to adequately keep cities safe. Minneapolis, down 300 officers. What was officer morale like at St. Paul PD during the defund movement? What did you, as chief, do to maintain or build officer morale? And did you have a retirement issue at St. Paul during that defund the police movement?
Yes, we did, and we do. We lost a lot of our officers to retirement. We lost a lot of our officers to PTSD claims, and it took a significant hit. At the same time, we had politics continue to creep into policing, and we had the defund the police movement across the country, which has obviously been a failed experiment. We understand that we need enough police. We don't need more police for the sake of more police. We need enough police, and enough police means we need to rehire what we've lost and then go from there. Right now in St. Paul, to this day, we're still 60 down, and it's hard to hire. And I used my bully pulpit, so to speak, to push back on that as much as I could while serving as St. Paul police chief, because I could see what was around the corner. We continued to lose officers. We had our academies that were canceled back in 2020, and I knew that it takes a year from hire until the time that officer is out on solo patrol. It takes a long time and a lot of money and a big investment. We lost out on a lot, and now we're still to this day trying to catch up with that. So we need to do better in that regard. We need all of our politicians on whatever side of the aisle you're on. We need our community members to help promote the need for good police officers to be patrolling in our communities. And then once they get there, is to support the good work that they do. And again, we have to hold ourselves accountable to the standards of our community. But we need to support good police officers doing the good work in our community.
So, Chief, there's the American society that we all see from day to day in our ordered communities. But below that level, there's always been an undercurrent of crime and violence. One of the fastest learning curves, as I understand it from talking with my friend Joe, for new officers when making police work a career is understanding how truly violent that undercurrent can be. Police departments have traditionally had these specialized units, as Joe was mentioning a little while ago, to take on the most violent aspects of our society. But with departments losing officers at these very high numbers and the challenge of finding these excellent recruits to replenish departments, specialized units have been disbanded in many departments across the country. Were you able to maintain those specialized units in St. Paul at a time when many departments could not? What are examples of those specialized units and the work that they do to keep citizens safe for the St. Paul Police Department that you had under your watch?
That's a great point, John. Thanks for bringing that up. We were down at one point well over 100 officers in our department, so we had to make some significant cuts to our operation, consolidate some units, and do away with some of the units.
And can I just ask very, very quickly? So both Minneapolis and St. Paul, you lost a lot of officers during that time frame. You were losing veteran, experienced officers, weren't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. People with many years on, 15 to 20 years, that was the average range, which is a lot of experience going out the door. So I had to disband the traffic unit, for example. Traffic unit that helps keep cars slow in our neighborhoods, helps protect pedestrians and bicyclists that are traversing around our communities. as a result, and not just me, but other departments across the country, as a result, traffic deaths have gone up. Mm-hmm. Cars are driving faster. People are less safe, right? So there are consequences. The mounted unit that helps with civil disturbance and public relations and helping build our bank of trust, no longer there. The force unit, focusing our resources on community empowerment, helping neighbors when they have problem properties and rental properties, bring a remedy to those situations. So the service that we've been able to provide over the years has gone down significantly. I've had to cut in our department many of the units that are providing services to victims. It's not just the 911 call, as you know. It's following up to make sure that we hold offenders accountable for the crimes that they're committing. The only unit that I was able to keep it fully staffed and at the cost of other units is the homicide unit in St. Paul. Our homicide rate has gone up, and but I'm also proud of the fact, and this is, to me, the thing that our community needs to understand, is when you have a fully staffed unit like our homicide unit, you have a 90% clearance rate in homicides.
That's exceptional.
When across the country, you're seeing homicide rates at 50 and 60%. I don't say that to brag about our department. I say that to show that if you invest properly in your police departments, you will bring justice to victims and you will prevent future crimes, because we all know that very few people commit most of the crimes. When you hold them accountable, right, you will have less crime.
Joe and I have had that conversation, too, about, like, sentencing guidelines and things like that. So, but that's another show.
In discussions with my co-host, John Olson, we have come to the conclusion that in order to regain public trust in urban centers, police departments and its officers are going to have to be better than ever. Better educated, better trained, better candidates and recruitment programs, better pay offered to attract the best recruits and retain the best personnel. One criticism we have of the current hiring and training process for police officers in Minnesota is there is no standardization. It's variable by university, college, or agency. We would like to advocate for standardized training in Minnesota. Our thought is to turn Camp Ripley, home of both the National Guard and the State Patrol Academy, into a training center for police officers, the Minnesota Law Enforcement Training Center. There's training center could not only provide the full scope of initial training that all law enforcement officers must receive, but could also serve as a center of training excellence for continuing and advanced law enforcement training for officers across the state. After an applicant completes their degree and is screened and hired by a law enforcement agency, the selected trainee reports to Camp Ripley, where they would be trained by active duty law enforcement officers, men and women who currently serve on the streets all across our state in an elite program similar perhaps to the FBI's training program at Quantico, Virginia. Sheriffs and police chiefs select their best officers in rotations to serve as trainers at Camp Ripley. A culture of standardized excellence from the very beginning extend throughout careers. Chief Axtell, what are your thoughts about standardized training excellence at Camp Ripley for all police recruits in the state of Minnesota? What are the pros? What are any potential cons to an idea like this?
Not to put you on the spot or anything.
Yeah, right. No, that's a great
and you had your own exceptional academy yourself.
Right.
So
yeah, it's a very interesting idea. I like the idea. We need better standards and expectations for all police officers in this state. I believe we have approximately 11,000 police officers in Minnesota right now. Most of those officers are from smaller agencies, and every community, right? Every community in this state has different expectations and standards of what they like to see in their police officers. So the challenge would be to make sure that every community standards is attended to during that training. In St. Paul, we have a 5-month academy. We've committed to that because it's really, if you don't have a good foundation, you'd have a 30 to 35 year investment that could be shot if you don't do it right on the front end. Mm-hmm. But making sure, again, that you first and foremost, you hire the heart and make sure they understand that what the expectations are from our community is so critically important, but you have to have a guardian mindset with whatever you do in policing. And I don't care if you're in Black Duck, Bemidji, Brainerd, Pequot Lakes, or Worthington, you know, the same should apply. But I think the challenge would be politically from the 87 sheriffs in this county and the chiefs and the city managers and the mayors to make sure they're not trained in a way that is against their community standards, and which is why we have a 5-month academy. So no matter what you have learned, wherever you have worked, when you come to St. Paul, we have 5 months of you learning our community before you police the community. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, if you're not learning in a way that reflects our community standards, you can't be a St. Paul police officer.
So, Chief, we know that post-traumatic stress disorder, it's a mental health condition triggered by a terrifying, horrific event that somebody might have gone through, either experiencing it directly themselves or witnessing it. Symptoms can include flashbacks, nightmares, severe anxiety. First responders frequently experience these traumatic events. I mean, you're there to respond to people having the very worst day of their lives, shootings and stabbings, fatal accidents, abused children, just to name a few. Yet police departments have traditionally stayed away from providing dedicated counseling programs led by mental health professionals, fully funding those programs to help officers cope with traumatic experiences that they literally experience on a daily basis. And there's always been sort of this culture of you're too tough to have to deal with those things. The military is emphasizing mental health programs. We've been doing that quite a bit in the military of late to try and help support our combat veterans, which, you know, as you know, we're losing something like 21 to 25 a day on average to suicide. There now seems to be a momentum to help police officers and other first responders to deal with this challenge. As someone who's been on the top of a very large police organization, do you believe that the mental health counseling is important to provide for your officers? And while you were chief of police, did the St. Paul Police Department implement mental health support programs for officers? And by this, you know, as Joe and I have talked this through, you can't make an optional thing. Maybe it needs to be a quarterly. Everybody goes to talk to somebody on a quarterly basis. They can talk about basketball if they want for an hour, but they have to do it because it affords those officers a safe place to vent if they really need to.
Yeah, John, thank you so much. That is so critical. You know, in the 21st century policing report that some of the greatest minds in policing in the country came together back in 2014, 2015 under the presidential task force and came up with recommendations, 6 pillars recommendations for good policing in the country. Pillar 6 of that task force report specifically talks about officer wellness. It's really critically important. You know, our officers see things that really aren't meant to be seen by a human being on a daily basis.
And you can never unsee those things again.
You can't unsee it. You can't. We all of us who've answered calls for service can see and smell things from years ago that really don't exist anymore. So it really is seared into your mind. So yeah, we have had a longstanding employee assistance program in St. Paul. Funding is a big challenge as we're struggling with funding in police departments. But that wellness, the peer support, we instituted our peer support program so officers can talk to other officers. And then last year, I made it mandatory starting last year in January of 2021. That every officer has to have an annual check-in with a wellness check with a mental health counselor. And you're right, there's some grumblings about doing that. Now, I took, as the leader, I believe that I need to lead from the front. So I took the first appointment, which I found, you know, to be helpful. But I told our officers, you know, some of the officers were a little stubborn about it. So they said, I'm not going to do that. And I said, well, actually you are. You're going to go to the meeting. I don't care what you talk about, but I'm paying you to go to the meeting. And if you don't want to participate, that's fine. But what I found out is getting some feedback from officers who actually came back and said, you know, Chief, I thought that was a bunch of crap. But I really got a lot out of it. And I look forward to the next one. As a matter of fact, they can do more frequent, more than once a year. And that's really where we have to get. We're human beings. We all have challenges. We all have emotions. And we shouldn't expect our police officers, just because they wear a uniform and a badge, that they are superhuman. We have to attend to those needs that we all have as human beings.
You're listening to Public Policy This Week on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1, broadcasting out of Northfield, Minnesota. I'm Joe Mrawczyk. My co-host is John Olson. Joining us on our program this morning is Todd Axtell, CEO of the Axtell Group, and he's just retired from Chief of Police for the City of St. Paul. Chief, this spring I read a terrible news story out of New Orleans about a 73-year-old woman that was carjacked in the middle of the afternoon, and during the commission of the crime, she was dragged down the street by a car. Her arm was severed, and she bled to death on the street in the neighborhood she lived in. All four of the offenders were teenagers, the youngest 15. Local police departments have also been dealing with increases in violent crime in the metro, including carjackings, often committed by juveniles. Society certainly needs brave, highly trained officers and police departments with strategies to combat violent crime. Further, the courts have an important role to play in putting violent offenders away in prison. But I also believe there has to be more resources put into programs to transform the lives of at-risk youth, children that are struggling with behavioral, mental, and emotional health that may be prone to violence and a life of crime. I mean programs where these at-risk youth are taken out of the environments they are in and sent to residential camps or ranches, perhaps, to provide education, counseling, healing, and hope to transform lives. Chief Axtell, what was your experience with young offenders during your police career? What are your thoughts about programs to help at-risk youth lead productive, satisfying lives and avoid becoming a part of the criminal justice system?
Yeah, it's a great question, Joe. Great point. You know, as I have been talking about this for many years now, with you know, there's been, I believe at times there's been some misplaced empathy, I'll call it, from the judicial system, not wanting to incarcerate people, because we know that a vast percentage of people incarcerated in the criminal justice system are communities of color, and we have to, you know, do everything we can to attend to that and understand it and recognize it, but also making sure that you know, I view this as kind of the hub of the wheel. The criminal justice wheel and the spokes that make up the wheel have to work in concert, from the 9/11 call to the 9/11 response, to the prosecution, the bench, and the accountability, and the justice system. While there's some incarceration, we've lost our way in some regards with not holding people accountable of all ages, young and old. And I believe that having a prevention, intervention, and accountability program that, number one, supports victims of crime first and foremost, right, and secondly, tries to prevent future crime from happening at the same time. And I think you can do that in a thoughtful, respectful way. And the parents are asking for it. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many times I've had conversations with moms and dads who said, please take my son or daughter to jail. They're going to kill themselves or kill somebody else, and continue to carjack victims and rob people in places. They're looking for help. So we do need more resources where the criminal justice system can put people so they're not going to reoffend, and also do everything we can to provide mental health training, chemical dependency support, and all of the things to help them reintegrate into society at some point. One of the things that's really important with this is when you talk about, you know, a camp or an incarceration facility, is to make sure we don't take someone from the inner city and put them in a bus and drive them up to International Falls and put them in a facility where people only look like people from International Falls for the most part. Mm-hmm. We need people who can relate to and look like young people who are in the system, so that they have a sense of hope and have the ability to reintegrate someday. and there will be people who continue to commit violent crimes, and we have to, again, advocate for the victims of crime. And if that takes longer prison sentences or incarceration, then so be it, because, again, we have to protect the next victim.
Would we be better served by, I mean, you read it in the news all the time where we have these repeat offenders in and out of prison, in and out of the jails, very relatively short sentences, time off for good behavior, quote unquote. Would we be better off if these violent criminals, on the very first time they were convicted, they were put away for at least 10 to 15 years till they get beyond these urges as a young man to do violent crimes, get into their mid-30s, for instance? Would we be better served by that?
Yeah, you know, I've always talked about, you know, the fairness of the criminal justice system, and some people will say, well, we shouldn't be incarcerating people, we should be, you know, helping them, et cetera. And I believe in some of that, but when you commit a violent crime, or you commit a crime with a gun, and you hurt someone, there shouldn't be no wiggle room, regardless of your age. And I tell our community all the time, and some of the advocates for releasing people, is that if you take a young person that's 16 years old, for example, that continues to do carjackings, now we could incarcerate that young person for maybe 3, 4, 5 years and get them some training and mental health assistance, and hopefully they come out of it and become productive members of the community. But if we don't have accountability on the front end, what happens is that young 16-year-old becomes 18 years old, and then they carjack a vehicle with a gun, and we turn it over to the U.S. Attorney's Office, and now it's a federal crime where that young man or woman will serve 20 to 25 years on a crime when they could have received the resources that they needed to serve a 3 to 5 year sentence on the front end. To me, that's not fair. I mean, that's not, and there's no common sense in that approach. We need to hold people accountable for specific actions when they're hurting other people. Plain and simple, that's what it's all about.
When I was on the street, crack cocaine and heroin were our primary problems. Then later, methamphetamine. I read multiple articles this week about fentanyl. 50 times more lethal than heroin, 100 times more lethal than morphine. In 2021, about 82,000 Americans died from opioid-related overdose deaths. And fentanyl was identified in over 75% of adolescent overdose deaths. The articles I read were largely about teenagers dying from fentanyl supplied by other teenagers, accidental deaths. How big a problem is fentanyl?
It's a huge problem. We saw the trend coming many years ago. I remember it as a new chief going out to New York and meeting with law enforcement leaders and chemical dependency experts out there. And we saw this train coming, and we never guessed that we would have this year. I'm sure we're going to have well over 100,000 people in this country that are going to die from fentanyl overdoses. It's a huge problem. A lot of the products are coming out of China. They're going to Mexico. They're coming across the border up into our country. And they're getting into the hands of people who are craving the drug. And, you know, we've had, I don't know how many lives have been saved by police officers across the country. We put Narcan in the pockets of every one of our squad cars several years ago.
Put in schools now.
There have been so many lives saved as a result of using Narcan. But the problem is going to continue to be a huge problem. You know, awareness and education is so critically important. Having conversations with our children about the dangers of this. The part of the business that I'm running right now, we've talked to parents and school systems. Even Columbus, Ohio had us down to talk about some of their charter schools down there about just awareness relating to some of these overdoses. And it's just something that really continues to be a concern, which is why it's so important to have, again, a zero-tolerance approach on enforcement related to fentanyl cases. We're going to see more murder cases when you deal in fentanyl products and somebody overdoses. You're going to see a lot more second-degree murder charges coming out, too. It's a big deal.
So Todd Axtell, you just mentioned it. You've reinvented yourself after retiring from the St. Paul Police Department. This next chapter of your life, you're the co-founder and CEO of the Axtell Group. What exactly is the Axtell Group? What services does the Axtell Group provide? And what is your vision moving forward? Where do you want to take the organization?
Yeah, so this has been a lot of fun over the last year thinking about this. We're a boutique safety, security, crisis management, crisis communications firm that helps other organizations establish and build their bank of trust. The philosophy that I had in St. Paul, we're a battle-tested group of people who understand the dynamics of public safety, and we want to help other organizations. Right now, we're helping private sector, public sector government organizations, healthcare systems, mm-hmm. School systems, and it's been a lot of fun. You know, I mentioned earlier that, you know, as police chief for the last 6 years, you don't sleep through the night. You're thinking about stuff. You're getting the phone calls, and it's never to bring you any good news. And so I haven't missed that part of the job. There's much less stress in this work. It's very fulfilling. It's fun work. And I hope to be able to do this and help other organizations for many years to come.
All right.
Well, that was a great and informative and fast hour of radio. Our guest for today's episode of Public Policy This Week has been Todd Axtell. Todd, thank you for being a part of our program.
Thank you, Bob, very much. It's been great.
Folks, that concludes this week's edition of Public Policy This Week. We're on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. And we're here every Friday morning from 10 to 11 a.m. Your hosts for today's program have been Joe Moravchik and John Olson. It is our hope that this show can be a small step to having important, meaningful, in-depth conversations about public policy challenges and solutions, staying away from the high-volume, rhetoric-filled conversations that are so commonplace today.
We want our listeners to be informed by facts as they hear from our experienced policy experts, and then to be able to use that information to make the best personal decisions about highly complex policy issues.
Thank you for joining us today for Public Policy This Week. We hope you'll join our show again next Friday morning at 10 a.m. Have a fantastic Friday afternoon, everyone, and a superb weekend. Take care.
You've been listening to Public Policy This Week. Tune in every Friday morning at 10 a.m. for more conversation with policy experts. Remember, this show can be found on your favorite podcast platform or stream it from kymnradio.net.